Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Chuck Reese wanted to hear a particular kind of voice from the South, a voice that loved and appreciated this part of the world while acknowledging all its faults, past and present. He didn't hear that voice enough, so he created a website called The Bitter Southerner. For 5 years now, he's opened it up to all sorts of writers, photographers, and filmmakers with their own visions of the South. And recently, he started a podcast to do the same thing. He sat down for our podcast to talk about it. Here's our conversation. So, Chuck Reese, we knew each other just a little bit in Athens at UGA. I think I was on the red and black staff as a freshman when you were a senior. But what I remember most is not too long after you left, you went up to New York.
That's right.
I remember hearing this, and I may not have this correct, that you had started some sort of club or something for Georgia expats who are up in New York City. Do I remember that right?
I didn't start a club. It never was called a club, but the another fellow you might remember from our Red and Black days, who later went on to be the editor of Spin magazine, Charles Aaron, moved up to New York almost a year after I moved up there the first time after he graduated, and we lived together in a little studio apartment that I was in for the last couple months of the lease, and then we found an apartment in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn that actually had a little tiny New York City backyard. And we bought a Weber grill, and you couldn't find any good barbecue in New York at the time. I'm not sure how that is now, even, but we started trying to learn how to make decent barbecue because you couldn't find it, you know. And, you know, it just sort of kept attracting people. We would do these things. And it wasn't just expat Georgians. It was expat Southerners.
Lured by barbecue smoke, like the bat signal or something.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I remember a couple very well who I became very good friends with, Patrick and Jane Day, who are back home in North Carolina now. And they had their Carolina method for doing a pork shoulder, and I had my method, and we kept arguing. We decided we were going to do this, they would do their shoulder and I would do mine, and we'd serve them both to everybody at the same time and let us vote on which one was better. And we kept arguing with each other so much when we were out with other friends that one of the friends finally said, "I wish y'all would just shut up and do this in the spirit of harmony." So we actually called that one event the Spirit of Harmony Barbecue, and I still have an old cabinet door or something that a painter friend of mine up there painted into a sign for the Spirit of Harmony Barbecue, and that's still hanging in my living room today.
Oh, that's fantastic. So obviously, as anybody who's heard you for this last couple of minutes knows, there ain't no doubt where you're from when you talk. And I wonder what that was like for you as a young man in New York in the early 80s.
Well, it's really interesting because in the 5 years since we started The Bitter Southerner, I cannot tell you how many stories we've heard about people going to far-off cities and being ridiculed or having assumptions thrown at you when you take the Southern twang there. For me, it was always interesting, and the truth is it wasn't that difficult to overcome. A lot of people thought, when they'd hear somebody talk like me, that I was dumb. you know, or backward, or both. And typically, you know, after I would have a 4 or 5 minute conversation with somebody and they could figure out that I was, in fact, capable of constructing a compound complex sentence on the fly, suddenly my accent became charming and not off-putting, you know. So it was a real interesting experience, and I kept trying to, you know, I kept trying to share the value of my culture with them. And this was particularly in the first 4 years up there that I spent with Adweek magazine, you know, like they had for the holiday party every year, they had a talent show. And, you know, reporters or advertising salespeople would, you know, some of them would sing Broadway show tunes. Someone would, you know, might read something or whatever. But it was a staff talent show. And what I would always do is sit down at the piano and play and sing an old gospel hymn of mine, you know. And every year I would call it a hymn for the heathens, you know, because I thought they probably were heathens and needed to hear a hymn.
So you've talked a little bit about being at Ad Week when you first got up there and seeing, you know, as part of your job, you would see like TV pilots and things like that, that, you know, some of them made it, some of them didn't. And I remember you talking about sort of noticing the Southern stereotypes that you would see in those things. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The thing that I began noticing, because, you know, not only did I cover what were then the big three television networks, and I would see all their pilots, but I was also covering the big magazine publishing companies. So I would see magazine prototypes, too. And, you know, I began to notice after a couple of years that every time I saw one of these new things, it seemed like the South, like you could only see it through two specific lenses. And the first one looked kind of like, probably the best way to describe it is the opening party scene from Gone with the Wind, but maybe in modern clothing, you know?
Sure.
Which is, you know, imagery that persists and until this day. You still see it in magazines like Southern Living. Not that I have anything against Southern Living, because that's the sort of thing they write about. But, you know, you would see either that, or you would see something that, like, I was in New York a few weeks ago to interview Roseanne Cash, and she asked me to talk about this a little bit. And I explained the first stereotype to her, and she said, yeah, and the other one was the, like, the Hatfields and McCoys. And that really is the model for it. It's like, you know, you see, you know, when we were kids, it was the Beverly Hillbillies,
right?
And, you know, that's gone on up through Honey Boo Boo and Duck Dynasty. And even if you see Southern reality shows these days that don't play off that stereotype, they still play off the other one.
Right.
And
nobody's ever too far from a shotgun.
Right, exactly. You know, and the only difference is whether your shotgun is bespoke or not. I'd seen all this stuff going on, and I'd lived in cities and in places that were more, you know, vastly more diverse than the environment I grew up in. And the South is a more complex thing than could ever be expressed by two simple stereotypes. There are so many people who don't, you know, aspire to or fit those stereotypes. And one thing that was common to both of them was that you rarely saw people of color, even though this region is the most racially diverse in the nation.
Yeah. Before I get into the bitter Southerner and how you sort of got into all those issues, I want to take one little side trip to a job you had before all this. You worked for a while for Zell Miller.
I did.
Who was he the governor at the time of Georgia?
He was the governor of Georgia. It was during the first of his two terms as governor. And I was there for about 2.5 years.
And talk about a complicated character, at least from the outside. He seemed to me to be one of those guys who did fit that Southern stereotype a bit of, he was liable to say anything when you put a microphone in front of him, but also seemed to be a very astute and sharp guy, not just sort of politically, but intellectually. And I guess I wonder what your impressions were, and maybe any stories you have from your time working with Zell.
I have so many stories. And, you know, personally, the things that I remember about Miller most fondly is, first, you know, we're both from the same part of Georgia. We're in the mountains up in northeast Georgia. And in the press release when I left the job, he said, "Chuck has always understood my mountain psyche." And but he never could pronounce the word right. He said mountain psychic. You know, I did feel a connection with him on that level. But, you know, we also shared two other passions, which were music and baseball. He always had a current copy of the baseball encyclopedia under his desk, so he could look up anything he needed to whenever he wanted to. Mm-hmm. And he once joked to me, and I egged him on, that, you know, songwriters don't get enough credit. We should pass a bill that would force DJs to announce not just the name of the artist, but also the name of the songwriter. And, you know, he was friends with all these tremendous, like, legendary songwriters in Nashville. And he would invite them to come spend the weekend at the governor's mansion. He'd feed them barbecue and they'd swap songs in the basement. Man, I got to see Harlan Howard, who wrote I Fall to Pieces for Patsy Cline, play I Fall to Pieces in the basement of the governor's mansion.
That had been worth the whole trip right there, don't you think?
Yeah. And I remember, you know, my office was directly underneath the governor's office in the Capitol. And there was an ante room behind my office and an ante room behind the governor's office. And there was a circular staircase that connected the two of them. So I often got these phone calls from him that were like, "Get up here," you know, and it always meant, you know, some kind of fire had broken out that we had to put out. But every now and then I would get these calls that were like, "Hey, come up here. I got somebody I want you to meet." And they were always, you know, these great figures from Southern music, you know, Chips Moman, who was one of the white boys in Muscle Shoals in Memphis who crossed the line to work with black musicians, you know, and make soul music back in the 60s. Moman was a co-writer of a song called The Dark End of the Street that is still one of my favorite Southern soul songs of all time.
James Carr.
James Carr, buddy. You got it. You know, another time he gave me a call like that, and I walked up the stairs and stuck my head in the back door of his office, and he goes, "Chuck, I'd like you to meet Mickey Mantle." And so I got to sit and talk with Mick for a while, you know. So, you know, he was, like every Southerner, he's more complex than the stereotypes that grew up around him.
So that brings me back around to the bitter Southerner. And my understanding is that, like many great Southern stories, this one sort of starts with liquor. Am I right?
Yeah, it did. what happened was, Tommy, I don't know about you, but it took me a long time to get the marriage thing right. You know, I didn't meet the right one until I was like 50. And, so my then fiance, Stacy, and now wife, we spent Halloween week of 2011 in New Orleans. And, you know, back in the aughts, this whole revival of classic bartending was happening in places like New York and San Francisco, but it had begun to crawl into the South. And so we decided, you know, to go to some places in New Orleans that had never stopped doing it right, you know. And we spent some time with some amazing bartenders and, you know, just kind of watched them work and talked to them. And the week after we got home, I saw this thing pop up on Facebook. It was some story about the 50 best cocktail bars in the world. And, you know, it turned out it was from some, you know, a trade magazine that covers the bar business. And I was thinking, you know, probably one of those places we went to in New Orleans last week will be on here. And then I looked at it, and not only were none of those bars on the list, there wasn't a single bar in the American South. And I knew enough at that point to know that many of the sort of iconic drinks in every good bartender's catalog had originated in the South, like the Sazerac and the Mint Julep, et cetera, and so on. And I got a little peeved about that, and so I decided I would start a little cocktail blog. Both me and Dave Whitling, who is now one of my partners in the Bitter Southerner, and who is our design person who makes the thing look so beautiful, I told him, I said, I want to start this little blog. Would you design it for me? And he goes, sure. You know, so we got together one weekend at a coffee shop and started throwing around names for it. We started playing with the ingredients and cocktails, one of which is bitters. And, you know, we talked about, you know, whiskey and, you know, sweeteners and fruit juice and acid. And, you know, you didn't want to call it the juicy Southerner or the acidic Southerner. You know, but when we went the bitter Southerner, we were like, whoa, that's like a quadruple entendre. And Dave and I wound up taking another year to sort of, we'd meet most every weekend and like try to figure out what that name was telling us to do. And, you know, the so-called long form storytelling, you know, what you and I grew up calling feature stories, was beginning to get some momentum back then. And at this firm we were working at, we'd been doing that kind of content for some of our corporate clients. And we were like, you know, let's start a magazine because you don't need paper or ink to do it anymore. That's how the whole thing got started.
And so now you're 5 years in.
Yeah.
And how do you feel like it looks and feels to you now compared to what you thought it might be when you started?
I have to say I feel pretty good. I remember saying way back in the beginning, you know, that you could never, I mean, the goal of the thing has always, of course, been to change or at least to complicate people's narratives, the narratives people have in their head about the American South, right? And, you know, I remember saying in my first year of this that we would never expect that any one or two or three stories of ours, you know, would ever give somebody a complete and accurate picture of what it's like in the 21st century in the South. But I always said that, you know, after we're a couple years into this, I'd like to think that people could look at a cross-section of our big feature stories, you know, and you know, pick 10 of them, and that they really would get a good picture about the South.
So I know you can't sum it up in one story what the Bitter Southerner is like, but looking at it from the other end, what qualities do you think a Bitter Southerner story possesses? Or what are you looking for when somebody makes you a pitch?
Well, maybe the simplest way to illustrate this is to talk about stories about food, because obviously Southern food is a rich topic to explore. It's rare that we're going to do the typical 2018 model food story, which is like a profile of a chef, you know. We tend to look a little bit below that, you know. We like to look at the farmers too, you know. And I want to, basically, what we look for in pitches is somebody who can come in with a story idea about one thing that might be even a small thing, but that captures a larger point about the culture of the South and how it's more complex than the typical reader might think.
Obviously, you guys have covered an incredible wide range of topics, and you've sort of even split off. There's like a whole sort of subgenre on the site now that y'all label as sort of the folklore project, and kind of explain how those, in your mind anyway, can sort of separate out from the sort of day-to-day stuff y'all might do.
Sure. That was really interesting, and it's been very rewarding, and it does sort of take us to a larger point about what I've discovered in the Bitter Southerner that I never expected to discover. But to start by answering your question directly, literally from, I mean, we flipped the switch and turned the bittersoutherner.com on at 11 p.m. on August 13th, 2013. And there was nothing there but my own opening essay about what our intentions were. The next morning, I had an email from a guy in Athens, Georgia, who I knew a little bit, named Patrick Ferguson, with a story about his family, where he grew up. And that first year, we didn't do anything but one feature story a week. I used to joke with people that it's exactly like a weekly magazine, but it only has a cover story in it, and it's not on paper. Without solicitation, regular folks kept sending, like writing and sending their stories in. And we got to our first anniversary, and, you know, there was a pretty big stack of these things. And, you know, some of them weren't very good, but I was really, like, surprised and happy to see how many of them were great. And even if, you know, the prose wasn't necessarily the most lyrical in the world, the stories that they were telling were compelling. They spoke to why the person who wrote the story loved the South despite its warts, right? So when we hit a year anniversary, we were like, we got to start publishing some of these things. And we had this idea to call it a folklore project because that's what it is, kind of, you know, because we've invited people to send not just written stories, but old photographs, that sort of thing. And, you know, we've done a few interesting things, but, you know, that's turned into a really rich vein for us. And another thing that I'm proud of is that, like, when I look at our most widely read stories over the course of a year, which I've been doing the last couple of days, we always see quite a few of those folklore project essays. Like, we had one this year, and it was one of our biggest performing stories of the year, you know, feature, folklore, whatever, by a woman in Hazelhurst, Georgia, and it was called Breaking the Southern Code of Silence. And essentially, it was this really compelling story about all of the men who had sexually harassed her in the South over the years, and how women in the South had always felt, you know, that they felt like what they were supposed to do was stay quiet about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And she was going to break her silence.
And I noticed some of them tend to speak to each other directly or indirectly. I know you have two up on the site. Last time I looked, this guy who wrote, Why I Hate Free Bird. And then a woman replied with, in defense of Free Bird.
You know, it was funny that when I first saw Why I Hate Free Bird, I was like, this is really going to have to suck for me not to want to run.
Because from the title alone, you're sold, right?
Yeah. I mean, because we all grew up with that song. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, you know, the joke now is you yell Free Bird when a band's about to come back on the stage for an encore.
Right.
You know, it's like, play Free Bird, you know. Before that, it was Whippin' Post, and not a lot of people remember that. But, you know, I've both loved and hated Skynyrd in my lifetime, and I was like, I'm running that. And by the end of the day, all our readers on social media had invented a hashtag, Skynyrdgate. And I wasn't surprised when the very next week I got one that said, in defense of Freebird. And that one was very well written, too. It is a subject that Southerners of goodwill may debate, and it's kind of a safe discussion to have because you don't have to get too deeply into politics or religion to do it.
Well, I feel like I'm like you. I've been on both sides of my life. When I was a teenager, and it was, you know, they played it on 96 Rock every 5 minutes, and I got a little sick of it, not just for what it was, but what it represented. But now, mm-hmm. it almost has the opposite feeling when I'm, especially when I'm somewhere and I hear it unexpectedly. And I feel this like tremendous sort of emotional reaction to it that I never had when I was 18. I just thought it was, you know, a good song that kind of represented Southern rock. And then I got kind of tired of it. But now it's got all this weight that it didn't have before.
Well, I think that just comes with age. I mean, you never forget the things that you played in your car from age 16 to 18.
When we come back, Chuck Reese talks about how to finance a creative enterprise off of selling t-shirts and dish towels. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
In the second half of today's episode, you'll notice I asked Chuck Reese a question sent in by one of our listeners. Here's how you can do the same. If you go to wfae.org/southbound, you'll find a place where you can suggest guests for the show and questions you might want to ask them. If we get that guest and use your question, we'll give you credit on the air. You can also email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. We'd love it if you would subscribe to Southbound through your favorite podcast provider. And we'd love it even more if you'd rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That helps the show reach even more listeners. Thanks for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Chuck Reese. What do you see as a better Southerner doing in form of a podcast?
I don't think I could have told you this before we actually started producing. But here's the thing that I find as an editor that we're able to do on the podcast that would be very difficult, if not impossible, for us to do in print on the web. I've always felt like, you know, particularly after 2.5-3 years when we had developed a pretty deep catalog of, you know, well into the hundreds of stories that we had published, I saw a lot of patterns between them and how they were connected, you know? Like, if you could connect the dots between story A, B, and C, it really does bring to light something different about the culture of the South, something bigger. And I hope that it, you know, expands our audience some, too, because, you know, we have this business that we're trying to run, and it employs a couple people, and you know, we want to keep it growing, and we still feel like, you know, we haven't put the message out there quite enough yet.
I do feel like I have to ask this of anybody in any media outlet, especially somebody who's in charge of a media outlet these days. How are you guys doing financially, and what's the business model that you guys have put together?
Tommy, if somebody had told me 20 years ago that when you're in your 50s, you're going to be running a journalistic enterprise that is supported primarily by the sale of t-shirts and dish towels, I would have thought they were crazy. But that's really what it is. I mean, when we got to a year, it was like, okay, it's clear we're going to keep going. So we did two things. And the first thing we did was to try to sell some t-shirts. And we found this cool company in your home state called Cotton of the Carolinas that could produce t-shirts that, like, every t-shirt on the little label in the collar had a URL you could go to, and you could trace the cotton in your shirt from dirt to shirt. Like, who raised it, who ginned it, who spun it, who wove it, all of that. And we thought that's the kind of, you know, Southern sort of attitude we want to have. So we checked into that, and we ordered 50 t-shirts that just said, "I'm a bitter Southerner." And, you know, because having a t-shirt that is produced, you know, start to finish in a southern state, you can buy way cheaper ones elsewhere. You know what I mean? We had to sell these to make profit on them. We had to sell them at $40 a piece.
Right.
And we're like, we got 50 of them. Let's see what happens. And we put them for sale on the site, and they were gone in 45 minutes. So that gave us enough money to print 100 the second time, and they were gone in 90 minutes. And we were like, you know, and a lot of this owes to Dave's talent as a designer. You know, we were pretty good at putting words on shirts that people feel, you know. So we're like, okay, we can make money selling T-shirts. What else can we do? What if we did like a membership drive like public radio? So we had a 12-day membership drive where we were just, where basically we just beat the hell out of people on social media until they gave us money, you know.
I'm familiar
with
that.
We did that for, yeah, we did that, you know, for 12 days and wound up with enough cash in the bank to where we could put more of our time into it going into 2015. And that's when we almost killed it. Because none of us were business people, right? And we were very fortunate. In very late 2015 and early 2016, we began to talk to a company that is family-owned, headquartered in Athens, Georgia, even though they own no media properties there. They just like to live there. It's called Community Newspapers Incorporated, and they're one of the last sweet spots of the newspaper business. They own 28 separate small town weekly or biweekly newspapers stretching from northern Florida as far north as Spruce Pine, North Carolina. And they, you know, it's not like these people are venture capitalists, so they weren't able to invest a lot of cash in it. But, you know, Eric Neesmith, who is, you know, the son of one of the founders of this company, really understood what we were doing and just was a miracle worker in terms of transforming the operations as a thing. And if it, you know, so for the last 2 years, it really has run like a business. We have budgets, we have objectives, we have plans and strategies, and no longer is everything just haphazard. So, you know, if, knock on wood, Tommy, haven't gotten the numbers yet, but we have every reason to believe that 2018 will be our first year showing a profit. You know, compared to my corporate communications days, my lifestyle is dramatically, you know, smaller. Like I joked with a friend early on, you know, I was like, I feel like I'm working three times as hard for a third of the money. But man, I never, in all those years in corporate communication, sometimes it was like I enjoyed politics, but the corporate thing, I only really just kind of stayed in it for the money, you know, looking back on it. I remember a lot of days when I woke up and wasn't too excited about the idea of going to work. And I haven't experienced that in 5 years. I get up and go, ooh, I get to do this again today. I get to tweak the South today.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit in sort of a broader sense. I actually want to start by, we've started this thing through Southbound where we ask listeners to nominate guests that they want to hear on the podcast, and you are actually one of the first people who got nominated.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So by the way, for those of you who are listening, if you want to recommend somebody else, you can do that at wfae.org/southbound. So the listener who recommended you, his name is Chandler Carricker. And here's a question he had that I want to use to sort of take a broader discussion of where the South is today. But here's his question. I would ask Chuck what he thinks the most important and specific thing the South can bring to the table for making the U.S. as a whole a better and kinder place.
That's a very weighty question.
Our listeners don't come with the softballs, man.
Well, that's good. Well, here's what I think. I think that, you know, if you look at the divisive state of our nation, I mean, it's plainly obvious to me that we're so divided because we don't understand much about people who aren't much like us. The people who come together in the South with a specific intention of understanding people of other races, cultures, and classes, when they learn to talk to each other and when that kind of behavior spreads, I think it helps. I think it can help. I think it, you know, that's why, you know, we try never to be overtly political when it comes to issues of policy. We want our stuff to be more unifying than that. We will call you out based on a couple of things. All of us, you know, and certainly up through our generation, Tommy, all of us were taught essentially a false version of the history of the South. You know, I cannot tell you how many times since the Bitter Southerner began, I've had somebody tell me a story about how they took a quiz in middle school or high school about what the causes of the Civil War were, and they answered slavery and were told their answer was wrong. We were taught that alternative United Daughters of the Confederacy curriculum until very, very recently. And there are places where people still fight not to change that curriculum. And that's the first thing we got to overcome. Man, I will never forget the week after Dylann Roof shot all those members of Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. Ta-Nehisi Coates published a piece in The Atlantic in which he quoted many of the Confederate States secession declarations. And you didn't have to read more than about a paragraph into any of them to see a very strident defense of the institution of slavery. No one taught it to us. And all you have to read to know the truth is to read them. To really answer your listener's question, that's the adjustment we're all going through. Southern culture is a mix. It is a gumbo. It is literally a gumbo. A gumbo may be the most significant and symbolic dish that comes out of Southern cuisine because it has all our influences in the pot, the Caribbean influences, the European influences, the African influences. It's all in there. We need to all get together and figure out how to make soup with each other.
I want to ask a little bit about, or kind of get, I have this idea I keep coming back to about how much the South has absorbed sort of the rest of the country's culture and vice versa. And there are two things that I think about all the time when I think about this. A guy, Ed Williams, who used to be on the, used to write editorials for the Charlotte Observer. Mm-hmm. I remember him writing one time that, you know, people from all over the country are moving here. And, you know, everybody's drinking bourbon now and they sell sweet tea at McDonald's everywhere. You know, the South is winning in a sense. Like they've become part of us. And then I also think of the kind of the flip side of that, which is something that Spencer Hall, who's the great college football writer out of Atlanta,
yeah,
for SB Nation, who wrote after the 2016 election, he basically wrote, you know, okay, America, you're all the South now because you elected basically the kind of guy that we usually elect, you know, and he is, that is a Southern type candidate if you ever saw one, and now mm-hmm. he's president of the United States. And I guess mm-hmm. I'm trying to coalesce all this into a question. I guess my question might be, you know, how much have we absorbed of the rest of the country? How much have they absorbed of us? And how has that turned out, you think?
Again, a big question. I think what I'm more interested in is the absorption process. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know, you've got all this cultural migration within, or societal migration within the United States. You know, I was looking last week. The Census Department just came out with its 2018 estimates of state-to-state migration. You know, and you still see the trends of people moving into southern states. And what we've been continually dealing with in terms of interacting with our readers since we began, you know, we let people know from the very first that we were going to be different, that we wanted other voices in the conversation. And it's taken us longer than I would have hoped to get some real traction on that, but we've got it now. What we've heard from people is if somebody has moved, say, from Boston to the South, and let's say they've been here 10 years, fallen in love with the place, and decided that this is home for them now. I get letters that are like, all my family back in Boston wants to know why I would want to live in such a vast wasteland of ignorance. So I'll show them your website. And the obverse is, I'm from the South. I love where I came from. I love so much about it. I know what the problems were. But I'm out here in Seattle working now, and all my friends are surprised when I say anything affectionate or positive about the South. And so I use your website to show them we're not all like that. And I think that's what Southerners, whether they're Southerners by birth or by choice, run into.
You've talked quite a bit about how these last 5 years have surprised you and changed you in some ways. Go a little bit even further back than that. So that boy growing up in North Georgia, what do you know now that, and what do you feel now about the South that he didn't know and didn't feel back then?
One thing I definitely know is the value, the worth of people who aren't exactly like me. I know that the region I live in is filled with people who aren't like me. I didn't know I was even supposed to know that, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Ellijay, Georgia. But in a way also it stems back to my father. My dad was a music nerd like me, but he was a gospel music nerd. He, all his life, would periodically be singing bass in a gospel quartet. You know, he loved that better than anything else in the world. You know, he was an insurance agent by trade, but that's what he loved to do. And, you know, when I was little, you know, I was born in 61, so I'm old enough to remember Dr. King's assassination and Robert Kennedy's assassination, and George Wallace being shot, and seeing the Watts riots narrated by Walter Cronkite. It makes me feel ancient to say that, but I am. But, you know, my dad, his only experience beyond Gilmer County came courtesy of Uncle Sam. He was drafted into the Army in World War II and survived the Battle of the Bulge. But, you know, the thing that, once he got past 75 and was even willing to begin sharing some war stories with me, you know, it became clear to me that there was this one story that changed him fundamentally. His unit was one of the ones involved in the liberation of the concentration camp Buchenwald. And Dad told me a story, and I've written about this, where they got there and they were confronted with these two-story wooden barracks buildings. And, you know, they broke the first one open and, you know, sure enough, it was filled with really emaciated prisoners, Jews, who look like all those pictures you've seen, you know, when you study the history of the Holocaust. And he was like, we let them all out into the yard. And then we're like, okay, let's go upstairs. Upstairs will be full too. And they went upstairs and didn't find more prisoners, but found cases stacked on cases of canned food. And the irony of these people starving to death only about 6 feet beneath the food that they could have been eating stayed with him forever. And I think it made my dad really tolerant of people who were different from him. And I noticed when I was a young boy and we were watching all the civil rights movement stuff play out on TV that, you know, our home was a home full of gospel songs and hymns. And I started noticing then when I was a little kid that around that time he started pointing out to me, okay, when we sing Precious Lord, Take My Hand, a black man wrote that. His name was Thomas Dorsey. He was a minister, and he wrote a lot of great gospel songs. When we sing Have a Little Talk with Jesus, that was written by a black preacher from Chicago, from Chattanooga, named Clevant Derricks, you know. And he started making these points to me, and it was like, for some reason, Dad felt like he needed to acknowledge the contributions of people in other races. I think part of that probably came from what he was seeing on television every night in the news. And I know a lot of it came from his experience back during World War II. And, you know, I mean, really, the truth is that I think is the single greatest gift my father gave me.
Chuck, that feels like a good place to stop. Thank you so much, buddy.
It's been a grand pleasure.
You can't sum up the South in any one thing, nor should you want to. We contain multitudes. We listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd and Outkast, work in skyscrapers and in the fields, eat sweet cornbread and salty cornbread, and cornbread with jalapenos. Even a sight as deep and wide as a bitter Southerner can't capture it all. The best we can hope for is for all our Southern voices to keep singing, like some rowdy off-key choir. And what matters is that along with singing, we keep listening, especially to the voices that are different from ours. And maybe, every so often, we'll hit the same pure note. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web managers are Jessa O'Connor and Zuri Berry. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and every episode of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.